Good afternoon. It's nearly noon and time for the KMXT Midday News. Currently 42 degrees here in Kodiak. It has been a beautiful day. We're looking for scattered showers tonight, mainly before 1 a.m., then just a slight chance of rain after that. Mostly cloudy skies tonight, lower about 38. Calm winds will turn to the northeast, 5 miles per hour. For tomorrow, just a 10% chance of rain before 7 a.m., mostly cloudy skies after that, becoming sunny skies, a high near 47 tomorrow. Mostly clear skies on Thursday. Some good stargazing on Thursday night. Sunny skies on Friday with a high near 48. And just a chance of rain on Saturday. KMXT's Run the Rock was a big success, and the in-person results are already up on the website. You can view all the results by clicking on kmxt.org. There's a blue button for the Run the Rock results. The east side has a high tide coming up at 1:01 p.m. That's going to be an 8.4-foot tide. Or on the west side, your high tide's at 12:51, 14 feet.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Senate Judiciary Committee dives deeper in the latest round of questions for President Trump's Supreme Court nominee. NPR's Brian Naylor reports Democrats who've been resisting Judge Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation again press a conservative today on her views of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare.
The constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act is being challenged by the Trump administration and a group of Republican state attorneys general. The Supreme Court is scheduled to hear oral arguments on the case next month. In a law review article, Barrett criticized the legal reasoning behind a previous ruling written by Chief Justice John Roberts to uphold the ACA statute. But she told senators today her criticism does not extend to the law itself.
I think you're suggesting that I have some hostility to the ACA, which I assure you that I don't.
And Barrett denied suggestions that her criticism was meant as an open letter, as she put it, to President Trump to get him to nominate her to the court. Brian Naylor, NPR News.
Judge Barrett's fidelity to precedent is under scrutiny. Democrats argue the nominee has signaled through previous writings that she is willing to overturn Supreme Court precedents. They're worried about what that might mean for cases like Roe versus Wade, the opinion that legalized abortion nationwide. Senator Chris Coons of Delaware went back further to the precursor to Roe v. Wade, Griswold versus Connecticut. He asked Barrett if she thought the opinion that protects the right for married couples to use contraceptives free of government interference was correctly decided. Barrett declined to answer directly.
Are you unwilling to say, as so many currently serving justices have, that at least Griswold is not wrong?
I think Griswold isn't going anywhere unless you plan to pass a law prohibiting couples or all people from using birth control.
The 48-year-old judge was nominated to fill the seat left vacant after Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a liberal line on the court, died last month at the age of 87. Barrett's confirmation would give the high court a 6-3 conservative majority. Many of the nation's leading economists are worried about what they heard from President Trump today. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports Republicans seeking re-election addressed the Economic Club of New York and again promised a strong recovery but didn't say how.
The president delivered the virtual speech from the Rose Garden, the same spot where he promised speedy economic growth last year. But when asked whether the government would be able to pay off ballooning debt if another stimulus package is offered, he kind of dodged the question and would not give specifics.
No, it's very concerning to me, and we're going to start doing that. I think you're going to see tremendous growth, David, and the growth is going to get it done.
The president has repeatedly promised a rapid economic recovery if he's reelected, but top economists warn the recovery will be much harder, especially if the White House and Congress fail to agree on another relief package. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
This is NPR.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
The Kodiak region has seen its second COVID-19 case this week. The Kodiak Area Emergency Services Organization reported its most recent case this morning. It says this one appears to be travel-related, involving a person who had traveled recently and is currently in isolation. This brings the total number of COVID-19 cases for the Kodiak Island Borough since April to 96. There are currently 13 cases classified as active locally. Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz has resigned. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George has this story.
Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz resigned on Tuesday, a day after the mayor acknowledged what he described as a consensual, inappropriate messaging relationship with a television anchor. Berkowitz's chief of staff, Jason Bockenstedt, made the announcement at Tuesday evening's assembly meeting. The announcement was met by applause from the audience.
The statement from the mayor reads, "It is with profound sadness and humility that I resign as mayor of the municipality of Anchorage."
The mayor's decision leaves a leadership void in Alaska's largest city as daily COVID-19 cases climb to record highs and as Anchorage remains deeply divided over the measures Berkowitz's administration has taken to fight the pandemic. Under Anchorage City Code, the chair of the assembly serves as acting mayor in the event of a vacancy. While Felix Rivera currently holds that position, assembly members said in interviews on Tuesday that it's likely the assembly would reorganize if Berkowitz resigned, and the body could choose a different chair to serve as acting mayor. If the vacancy occurs more than 90 days before a regularly scheduled election, a special election would need to be held. Since the regular election isn't until April, that's likely the case with Berkowitz's resignation. But Rivera said he's still waiting for a legal analysis to determine whether the assembly must hold a special election. From Alaska Public Media, I'm Kavitha George.
Last night, Anchorage's assembly voted to extend the city's COVID-19 emergency declaration for the fifth time. The vote came after a contentious start to the meeting, during which Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz's resignation was announced by his chief of staff, Jason Bockenstedt. Assembly members struggled to keep the crowd from shouting over the discussion, as several members of the public spoke in opposition to the extension, including Bernadette Wilson.
"You don't even know who among you is going to be the mayor, but you want to extend powers? 7 months. I'm here to remind you it's been 7 months to flatten a curve. There has been no curve. We are tired of your Nixle emergency alerts. There is no emergency."
Assemblymember Jamie Allard also opposed extending the emergency declaration.
"How can we possibly extend the emergency powers to a man that has just currently resigned to such poor judgment that is now negatively impacting the leadership of this administration and our city?"
The emergency declaration has allowed the mayor to make quick decisions related to the pandemic without assembly approval. That includes issuing public health orders, establishing measures like the city's mask mandate, and capacity restrictions on businesses. The assembly can repeal those mandates. Assemblymember Suzanne LaFrance said the pandemic continues to be a challenge for the city, but she said the assembly needs to transition to a more permanent solution.
"Over the past 6 months, we've taken a broad range of steps to mitigate the impacts of COVID-19 on our citizens, but we should now also consider exercising our legislative responsibilities to consider how to transition out of a perpetual state of emergency."
LaFrance proposed extending the declaration until November 30th rather than the December 31st initially written deadline. That amendment passed, as did an amendment proposed by Crystal Kennedy to clarify that the intent of the extension is to allow for time to transition back to normal municipal processes. The Assembly also agreed to hold a public hearing before any further extension of emergency powers. This year, the Elders and Youth Conference went virtual for the first time in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. This year's meeting was a little different, conducted mostly through pre-recorded messages and live Zoom calls. However, both keynote addresses highlighted the desire to keep thousands of years of Native culture moving forward, pandemic or not. KOTZ's Wesley Early has this report.
The four-day annual meeting seeks to strengthen the bonds between the oldest and youngest generations of Indigenous people, with Alaska Native people from around the state participating. Speaking over a Zoom call, Arctic Village Elder Reverend Traditional Chief Trimble Gilbert, who is Gwich'in, spoke of lessons he'd learned from elders throughout his life. In his roughly 35-minute keynote, he touched on his love of Native food, the importance of being prepared for winter, and the importance of keeping Native languages alive. He says it's vital to make sure that younger Alaska Natives can continue to experience their cultures and way of life.
We are very lucky to have all the resources we have in Alaska. But this summer, there's no fish in Yukon. Slowly, we get into a lot of changed, I know, since last maybe 2 years.
This year's commercial salmon runs in the Yukon River, Kotzebue, and Bering Straits regions were all considerably lower than in past years. While there's no definitive reason why, some have speculated it may be due to a warming Arctic climate. Additionally, Gilbert discussed the importance of safety in the face of the pandemic.
I hope young people listen to me when you go home, and a lot of them in city. We need you for the future. Make sure, take care of yourself. Wash your hands.
Gilbert says he's eager for the day when the virus blows over.
So we want someday, hopefully, we might get together again and to talk to each other face to face.
While the elder keynote address focused on passing down traditional knowledge, the youth address took aim at blood quantum. Blood quantum is an imposed standard of measuring, quote, Indian blood, often used to denote whether someone is eligible for tribal enrollment. Some tribes and federal agencies use blood quantum to also determine eligibility to participate in some cultural activities. 15-year-old Kylie Kanats Burton is Eyak, Aleut, Inupiaq, and Koyukon Athabascan, and is from Cordova. Since she was 5, she grew up beading and sewing skins, learning from her mother and aunt. However, under some blood quantum standards, Burton says she's less than a quarter Native and unable to participate in some cultural activities.
Many members of the Alaska Native community are deeply concerned with the growing numbers of young tribal members who are unable to hunt or utilize marine mammals. Hunting marine mammals, proper hide preparation, and skin sewing are essential components to Alaska Native culture.
The Marine Mammal Protection Act limits hunting and harvesting of marine mammals to only Indigenous people with at least one quarter Native blood quantum. Additionally, most regional shareholder corporations require a one quarter blood quantum to enroll and receive shares. There are estimates that roughly 60% of Alaska Natives living in and around the Gulf of Alaska don't meet that criteria. Burton says that she's worried for the future for herself and other Alaska Native descendants.
With blood quantum still used as an identifier of Native people, they will one day lose their status and recognition. The moment when tribal members are no longer Native enough based on colonial tactics that were established to assimilate is the moment Indigenous people are bred out of existence.
Burton ended her speech by urging others to speak out against regulations that limit who can identify as Native. For her part, she says she plans on educating her children one day about where they came from. The 37th Annual Elders and Youth Conference will wrap up on Wednesday with the reading and passing of several resolutions. This year's Alaska Federation of Natives Convention will take place starting Thursday and is also virtual this year. With help from Trip Krause, I'm Wesley Early, reporting in Anchorage.
A watchdog group hopes a lawsuit will shake loose more evidence of lost revenue from timber sales on the Tongass National Forest in southeast Alaska. As Joe McNicky reports, the borough government in Petersburg has sought answers about what's been done to fix problems with little response.
Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility is a nationwide watchdog group for current and former public sector workers based in Silver Spring, Maryland. It's published other internal documents from the U.S. Forest Service that faulted oversight, transparency, and accounting for timber contracts on Prince of Wales Island and near Petersburg. PIRA in August asked for the agency to release its audit of Tongass timber sales under the Freedom of Information Act. That request has yet to be fulfilled, and the group is asking the courts to enforce the law. Peers Pacific Director Jeff Rook expects the audit will confirm those earlier findings.
We think it's timely in that, as you know, there's an effort to dramatically expand logging in the Tongass by repealing the roadless rule, and that if passed as prologue and they've lost money on these earlier sales, you may be looking at a new gusher of red ink from new sales.
Rook says financials from the audit also should have been included in the recent environmental analysis on granting a full exemption of the Tongass from the Clinton administration's roadless rule. A decision on opening up more areas of the forest to logging and road building is expected in the coming weeks. Elected officials and residents in Petersburg also have asked about the extent of lost revenues from past timber sales and what's been done to correct oversight with sale administration. Alaska Regional Forester Dave Schmid said last November in a public meeting that the audit was nearly complete. KFSK and others submitted a Freedom of Information Act request for that audit last year, but the agency has not produced it. Petersburg Borough also sent letters seeking answers dating back to 2018. Forest Service Chief Vicki Christensen responded that the agency would share more information. That was in May of last year. Appeals to the Department of Agriculture's Inspector General for a separate external review also have so far been fruitless. In 2016, staff with the Washington Office of the Forest Service found, among other things, that timber companies are leaving behind lower-value hemlock and cutting more of the high-value cedar and spruce trees, which changes the economics of timber sales and how they're appraised and awarded. George Woodbury of Wrangell is a board member for the Alaska Forest Association, an industry group.
The reason it's not being taken is because we got the long-term sales taken away and the pulp mills taken away, so we don't have a secondary manufacturing facility. We are no longer able to use everything that we were before. It's a result of the environmental challenges and the fact that they've shrunk the timber supply so much. You can't have an industry big enough to have the infrastructure to utilize all the wood.
The Forest Service says it won't comment on the litigation. It referred inquiries to the Department of Justice, which did not immediately respond to questions this month. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation is now accepting public comment on a plan by Hillcore Alaska LLC to move a jackup rig to the Tyonic platform in Cook Inlet. The department issued a preliminary approval for Hillcore's plan on October 5th. The rig in question is a Spartan 151 jackup rig currently in storage in Seward. The Tyonic platform, where it would be stationed, is the northernmost platform in the inlet and the previous asset of ConocoPhillips. Hillcore, an independent energy company with a history of reviving old drilling infrastructure, brought the North Cook Inlet oil field in 2016. Petroleum News reports that the company says it has prepared a plan of development for a known pool beneath the oil field. Phillips Petroleum, the predecessor to ConocoPhillips, previously tested wells there, but the company never went through with development. The gas produced at that platform is transported to the Kenai Liquefied Natural Gas Plant in Nikiski, according to the AEDC's technical analysis report. The rig itself has an interesting history. Fury Operating Alaska, then Escapeda Oil and Gas, brought the rig to Alaska from Texas in 2011 in a Chinese-operated ship. That transport violated the U.S. Jones Act, and Fury was fined $10 million. When Fury went bankrupt in 2019, Hillcore bought its assets. Hillcore is now the primary gas producer in the inlet. The Spartan rig was used in the discovery of natural gas in the kitchen lights unit of Cook Inlet. It then went into storage in Granite Point Seward, where it still sits. According to Hillcore's application, the Spartan 151 rig has 11 diesel-fired internal combustion engines and 4 diesel storage tanks. Most of the engines are used for drilling. Brian Hirsch of ADDC says Hillcore submitted a permit application on March 18th. He says there's nothing unique about this particular permitting process.
Permittees are required to apply for an air quality permit in order to relocate a portable oil and gas operation from one facility to another.
Should the project be approved, it's expected to begin in early to mid-2021. Comments must be received by 4:30 p.m. November 4th. AEDC will move forward with the final decision about whether to approve or deny the permit once public comments have been collected. AEDC will hold a public hearing if one's requested according to the October 5th public notice. For details on how to submit a comment and links to Hillcorp's application and the AEDC's public notice, visit the online version of this story. 17 Central Peninsula schools will move online tomorrow. Central Kenai Peninsula schools will follow their Eastern Peninsula counterparts in shifting immediately to 100% remote learning as coronavirus cases spike locally. That's 17 schools from Sterling to Kasilof through Kenai, Nikiski, and Soldotna. The Central Peninsula has been inching toward the red zone for a while. Yesterday, the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District issued an advance warning that Central Peninsula schools would shift to remote learning if case counts continued to rise in the region. That was after several new cases were reported locally, part of a trend of rising numbers statewide. And today, the Central Peninsula entered the high-risk zone. Those rising rates are coupled with mounting cases within Central Peninsula schools. According to a memo from school district, contact tracing has put over 63 staff and students in isolation or two-week quarantine. Remote learning will begin tomorrow and extend for at least a week, says District Superintendent John O'Brien in a memo. This is the second block of schools on the peninsula to go remote within a week. Eastern Peninsula schools shifted to a remote learning model last week when the case rates entered the high-risk zone. Eight Superior Court and seven District Court judges are on the ballot in Alaska's 3rd Judicial District, which stretches from the Aleutian Islands to Anchorage to Cordova. But the process for judges to get on the ballot is far from self-explanatory. First, the Alaska Judicial Council oversees the nomination of judges. Then it sends a list of judges to the governor for appointment. The council then reevaluates judges after their first terms, which last 6 years for the Superior Court and 4 years for the District Court. Then the council issues recommendations on whether the judges should be retained, and it's up to voters to make the ultimate decision on whether each judge should keep their job. Suzanne DiPietro is the executive director of the Judicial Council. She says the system is meant to give power back to the people.
Alaska judges serve set terms in office unless the voters give them permission to have an additional term in office. And so the founders wanted to preserve the independence of the judiciary, but also to give the citizens some say-so in whether judges should continue in office.
She says the council also considers feedback from thousands of people the judges have worked with before issuing recommendations.
And that includes attorneys, municipal and state police officers and law enforcement, correctional officers, social services professionals, so people like social workers and guardians ad litem. The council surveys court employees. The council also surveys jurors.
DiPietro also pointed out that judges aren't allowed to run campaigns for their reelection.
One of the things that I find that not a lot of people are aware of is that even though judges' names appear on the ballot, the judges are prohibited under the Code of Judicial Conduct to campaign unless there's an active campaign against them.
The Alaska Judicial Council has unanimously recommended all judges on the November 3rd ballot for retention. The council publishes recommendations and information on its website at ajc.alaska.gov.
Today's KMXT Local News is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way. 486-4782.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. A simple new tool helps fishing boats save fuel. More after this.
The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute works to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. Learn more at alaskaseafood.org.
A new online tool helps fishermen tap into how they can make their vessels more fuel efficient. It's called the Fishing Vessel Energy Analysis Tool, and it was grounds tested in longline, seine, gillnet, troll, and pot fisheries.
during the course of that fuel efficiency project, we went out on several dozen vessels and installed data loggers and strain gauges and measured all the different types of energy load on the vessels. And so the purpose of the tool is to compile all that information and put it in a format that we hope will be useful to people.
Chandler Kemp is an energy consultant with Nunatak Energetics. From 2015 through 2018, he partnered with industry stakeholders to design the user-friendly fuel tool. Just enter data about the boat, its fisheries and operating patterns, and it gives estimates on what fractions of the fuel goes through the different loads.
For example, we'll give an estimate of how much energy goes to a refrigeration system versus propulsion versus electrical loads on the boat.
Outputs include freezer and RSW systems, hydraulics, and hybrid options. Kemp says a hybrid propulsion system can be a fuel saver in several fisheries.
Trolling and gill netting come to mind. There's a large fraction of the time where a propulsion engine is doing very little work. You're idling along at a low speed, maybe even deploying some drag bags to help slow down the boat, or you're just drifting with the net. And in those cases, it can make sense to have a secondary, potentially even a little electric, secondary propulsion system that allows you to turn off that main engine.
The energy analysis is free online, and it's loaded with short videos. Find it at the Alaska Fisheries Development Foundation website and find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods, serving Alaska's fishing communities since 1910. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
Fish Radio is supported in part by Joy Crafts, specializing in marine safety equipment. U.S. Coast Guard approved AMSI instruction for commercial fishing vessel safety procedures and drills, serving Kodiak for over 25 years. 486-6293 at 445 Shahafka Circle.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Welcome to your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It is already the 14th of October, the year 2020. Sun rose today at 8:42. It won't set again until 7:09 this evening, which will give us 10 hours and 22 minutes of glorious daylight. That is a loss of 4 minutes and 53 seconds compared to yesterday. We have a high tide coming up at 1:01 p.m. here on the east side, an 8.4-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 6:58 p.m., 7 p.m. of 0.9 feet. Your high tide for the middle of the night will be at 1:07 a.m., a 9-foot tide. And your low tide tomorrow morning here on the east side will be on at 7:18 a.m., a minus 0.1-foot tide. Over on the west side, and these are Uganic Pass ties, you have a high tide coming up at 12:51 p.m., 14-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 6:56 this evening of 2.6 feet. Your high tide tonight will be at 12:50 a.m., 14.4 feet, and your low tide for tomorrow morning on the west side will be at 7:16 a.m., minus 1.6 foot tide. 45 degrees here in beautiful downtown Kodiak. We are looking for some scattered showers this afternoon and tonight, mostly before 1 a.m., then just a slight chance of rain after that. Mostly cloudy skies tonight with a low of about 38. Calm winds. Tomorrow morning, a 10% chance of rain before 7 a.m., then mostly cloudy skies giving way to sunny skies with a high near 47 tomorrow. Mostly clear skies tomorrow night. It'll be some good stargazing tomorrow night. And sunny conditions on Friday with a high near 48. Mariners, here's your synopsis for the North Gulf Coast, including Kodiak Island waters and Cook Inlet. A 1,014 millibar low, 100 nautical miles east of Kodiak Island, will move to 100 nautical miles southeast of Seward and go to 1,020 millibars Wednesday night. This low will dissipate on Thursday morning. The resulting weather, Marmot Island to Sitkanak, variable wind at 10 knots and seas to 3 feet, Kodiak east side offshore. For tomorrow, northeast 20, seas to 6 feet. On the west side, the Shelikof, west winds to 15 knots and seas to 2 feet. For tomorrow, north winds to 15 knots, seas to 3 feet. For inside waters, Chiniac and Marmot Bays, variable winds less than 10 knots, seas to 2 feet for both. For tomorrow, north winds to 10 knots, seas to 2 feet.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.